This episode of Shaun of the South is brought to you by Case Knives, one of America's foremost manufacturers of premium knives. Case Knives have been treasured items that have been passed down to my family for generations. So put down the phone, shut off the TV, and go out and get your hands dirty and build something. Keep your hands sharp with a Case Knife.
Hey, you're listening to Shaun of the South Live. That music here behind me is Kentucky Bluegrass Sensation, The Whoops, everybody.
This old world gets me down, and I can't seem to find my way. Fear and troubles come around, I long for peace and another day. I wanna go out on the highway, I wanna start.
Whoops, ladies and gentlemen. Whoops.
Well, it is Easter time down south. Easter time in this part of our world. And I'm so excited I can barely hold my bladder. I'm not alone. Bishop Ricky Moore in Shreveport, Louisiana has Easter fever worse than I do. Yesterday, old Ricky dressed up like Jesus, and he took one deep breath, and he sealed himself inside a coffin. His deacons swore not to open the thing again until Easter morning. You heard me right. Ricky will lay in a locked casket for 36 hours. No food, water, toilet, or pound cake. Now, had Ricky attempted this stunt up north in, say, Toledo, Ohio, they'd have carried him off to the crazy house. but this is the South. So, Ricky is selling t-shirts. And why not? Easter's grander in our part of the world than it is in other places. It's the pinnacle of our calendar. Holidays like Christmas, Mardi Gras, and the SEC Championship. Well, they're cotton balls compared to Resurrection Sunday. Here, Easter is when all Dixie busts open like an azalea blossom. They're singing, seersucker suits, hidden eggs. Sunday lunch is big enough to make your ears ring and your feet swell. And we got gospel quartets. Oh, Lord, the gospel quartets. They visit town. They're fellas with big hair, big, tall, white hair, and belting out songs that'll make your granny stand up from her pew and shout, "Tell it, boy," which didn't like her at all. But she will sing it. And she will say that on Easter Sunday. In Alexandria, Alabama, off Highway 63, Mount Zion Baptist Church puts on a roadside pageant for folks who are driving by. A roadside pageant. To give you a better idea of what that is, three middle-aged men who look like your Uncle Joey, a little soft in the middle, stand on wooden crosses for half a day wearing nothing but their skivvies. One man reports, "It's a lot more dangerous than it looks. Jesus' knees could lock up if he ain't careful. The boys need to make sure they drink plenty of Gatorade out there." Well, I'm not going to lie. I've worn an Easter tunic or two in my day, and by God, I'm proud to say it. Because this is Resurrection Day, a day when we choose to believe in things that mean something, a day when we choose to get together with our family. And I don't mean the kind that's just out of blood kin. I mean the kinds that you've grown up with. It's the day when we get to sit in a wooden pew and listen to a man shout from a pulpit. It's a day when we attend churches our daddies grew up in and when we think about our friends who crossed the river. It's when mama wears her hat and it's when preachers holler things like, "He is risen," and you will holler back. And you will holler it loud enough to blow the roof off the place. Anyway, don't forget lunch is at noon. We got a good thing going in the fellowship hall. And for heaven's sake, somebody don't forget to unlock Ricky tomorrow morning. Happy Easter to everybody. How about another tune by the Works?
Sisters and my brothers, keep the faith. When the storm flies and the wind blows, go on at a steady pace. When the battle is fought and the victory is won, we will all shout together, "We have overcome." We'll talk with the Father and the Son when we make it to the promised land. We can walk together, little children. We don't ever have to worry. 'Cause through this world of trouble, we gotta love one another. Let us take a fellow man by the hand and try to help him to understand. We can all be together forever and ever when we make it to the promised land. Thou shalt not be afraid of the terror by night or the arrow that flies by day, nor for the pestilence walking in the darkness, nor for the destruction waiting in the noonday hour. We can walk together, little children. We don't ever have to worry. 'Cause through this world of trouble, we gotta love one another. Let us take a fellow man by the hand, try to help him to understand. We can all be together forever and ever when we make it to the promised land. traveling through this land. We can all be together, shaking our hands when we make it to the promised land. 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 We can make it to the promised land. Make it to the promised land. We can all be together forever and ever when we make it to the promised land. We can all be together forever and ever when we make it to the promised land. We can all be together forever and ever when we make it to the promised land.
I come from a generation of Americans whose parents cut their own hair. Yes, sir. My mama, she believed in saving money. She was tight. So was my father. My father was so tight you could feed him copper pennies and get electrical wire out the back end. And my mother was tighter than bark on a tree. They believed in saving money. And yes, this is a generation of Americans which I fear is passing from this great country. And they believed in cutting hair at home. Now, for a long time, my father would cut my own hair. And after he would finish, my hair looked like I had fallen into a wood chipper. He would get a stainless steel bowl, he'd place it over my head until the rim of the bowl was just above my eyebrows. He would get a pair of scissors, which he hadn't sharpened since the Eisenhower administration, and he would cut my hair, and it would leave a jagged line of hair just hanging in front of my face, and it looked like I had been made over with a weed whacker. And my mother would look at me as I came out of his workshop. He'd be sweeping up hair with a broom, and she'd say, "My God, that boy looks sick. You know what? I'm going to start cutting his hair from now on." And so that became her goal in life. My mother was fearless. When there was something that she knew needed to be done, she was always the one to do it. She wasn't about to ask for advice or read books. She was just going to learn how to do it on her own, and she was going to learn how to cut my hair. The only thing is, my mother should not be cutting hair. She didn't exactly know what she was doing. She got a pair of clippers from an old Army dock kit that looked like they were big enough to cut Mr. Ed from head to toe. And she fired them up and they made a sound like a commercial lawnmower. She set me down on a chair in her sewing room, and the floor was lined with towels and blankets. She was going to catch every stray hair which fell off my head. She fired up these clippers. She said, "Hold still and hold your head up." And I did. And then she snapped a plastic guard over the moving blades. This particular set of clippers, which I imagine was meant to shave elephants, had a special clip that you must secure before you start shaving. My mother had forgotten to secure that clip on the guard. She intended to shave the sides of my head and leave the long hair on top. I would trim that with some scissors. And what happened was, on her first pass, the plastic guard on the clippers popped off, and she left a mark on the side of my head that looked like I had fallen headfirst into a propeller. She covered her mouth and I saw it. And she walked in front of me and she looked at me. She was checking her symmetry. And she said, "Well, it looks like I'm going to have a bald little boy." And I screamed. I said, I said, Mama, no. But before I could get the words out, she had already scalped me completely like a Cherokee. And I looked at myself in the mirror. She patted my bald head, and it made a slapping sound. She said, Don't worry, it'll grow back, Uncle Fester. Uncle Fester. That's what the kids at school called me, and that's what I looked like, because I was a little bit of a chubby kid. And if I wore the color black, I really looked like Uncle Fester. Well, that was the last time she ever cut my hair. That was the last time my father ever cut my hair. From then on, my parents took me to a single wide trailer out in the sticks, run by a woman named Miss Tilly. It was a two-chair beautician salon. And Miss Tilly agreed to give my mother a discount because they went to church together. Miss Tilly was a Southern Baptist, so technically everything was okay. We were in no danger of losing our fundamentalist card because Miss Tilly was cutting my hair. Miss Tilly was a short woman. She was about as big as Minute. She had pure white blonde hair, bottle blonde hair, and it was the shortest hair I'd ever seen. Most church ladies I knew in the Southern Baptist tradition had 10-foot tall beehive hairdos, or they had frilly white hair that looked like you could grow African violets in it. But this was short hair. And she always wore red Converse tennis shoes. I loved that about her. Red Converse tennis shoes, which were high tops. She was a quirky woman. Some people called her something completely different. I'd heard her called crazy. I'd heard other folks call her touched. But whatever she was a sweet woman, and she cut good hair. My mother and I would walk into that single wide trailer, and I would sit down in that little waiting area. There'd be magazines on a little table. And I would browse the headlines of these magazines. They were mostly magazines for women. My mother would be beside me, and I'd see Cosmopolitan magazine, 7 Ways to Please a Man. And I would reach for that magazine. My mother would slap my hand and say, That magazine is not for you. All my life, I had only thought there were 1 or 2 ways to please a man, but this magazine claimed there were multiple ways. I owed it to my own gender to figure out what those ways were. And she said, not on my watch. I would sit there swinging my legs, waiting for my turn. There were women in the very back who were sitting underneath those hair dryers, those space bubble helmet hair dryers, and their hair would be wrapped with foil and rollers, and they had pink capes draped around the fronts of their bodies. And Miss Tilly would finish cutting someone's hair, and she would call my name, and she'd say, Come on up, Sean. And I'd walk to that chair, a vinyl chair, red vinyl, with chrome finish. And I would sit on that chair. She would drape a cape over me, and she'd say, I'm sorry, pink's the only color I got. And then she would spin me around to look at the mirror, and she would give me a service of kindness by asking me what I wanted to do with my hair. Now, I knew the truth, and she knew the truth. I did not have a say over what happened to my own head. I was a Southern Baptist fundamentalist child, and that meant that I did whatever my parents wanted me to do, and that meant that I wore my hair like every Southern Baptist fundamentalist child. And she knew this, but she entertained the idea, a fantasy of mine, that I could choose my own haircut. And she'd say, What are you thinking today, Sean? And I would imagine that I could get my hair cut any way I desired, like Elvis or Conway Twitty, or even a little bit longer, like the great Willie Nelson. And I'd pretend for that little moment in time, looking at my own reflection in the mirror, that I was a little bit more than just this child who was the kind of child who helped his parents clean up and wash dishes after a Wednesday night potluck in the kitchen. We were the kind of people who went to potlucks and we found ourselves on the other side of the potluck table, serving those who walked through the buffet line. We were never the first to walk through the buffet line. We were always the last, and we always ate the dregs because my mother did not believe in enjoying herself at any event where you could be working. We're always the first at the sink washing dishes. My father would have a towel slung over his shoulder, and my mother would be scrubbing, handing them to him. He would dry them, hand them to me, and I would put them away. That is how we spent potlucks on Wednesday nights, and we cut our hair to reflect that. So she would listen to me, she would nod, and she would look at my mother, and my mother would wave her one hand at me, and she'd say, a little off the top, a little off the sides. And Miss Tilly would get to cutting. And while she'd cut, I would get lost in the things she would say. She was such a good conversationalist. Those were the days when you got your hair cut by someone who knew how to talk. They were people who knew how to start up an entire session of chit-chat that chit-chat, an American art form, which I hope lasts forever and ever. But every day the cell phones take over the world just a little bit more. I'm afraid chit-chat and conversation are fleeting from our culture. But not with Miss Tilly. Miss Tilly would ask me questions about my life, about school, about everything. And I would answer them, and then I would ask about her. And she would tell me about herself while she used her fingers to measure the length of my hair and take snips with a pair of sharp scissors that she kept in a jar of blue alcohol. Miss Tilly was the daughter of a Pentecostal preacher, a holiness preacher. And when she was a girl, she started to get into Elvis, and she got into cigarettes, and a crowd of people who had fun on the weekends by riding around in Ford Thunderbirds and sipping a little bit of something clear out of a mason jar or cans of beer. And a holiness preacher will not abide this. Her father was mean. He beat his children. He was a vicious man. He preached every Sunday in a screaming loud voice, but at home he was a different man altogether. And somehow she's able to recall these memories about her life and about her father without making anyone seem like the villain. She was like most holiness girls her age. She had long hair, which grew down past her lower back, and a long denim dress, which brushed the floor when she walked, just down below her ankles. She wore a long-sleeved shirt buttoned down with the cuffs buttoned right around her wrists. And she wore appropriate shoes. Appropriate shoes, not those Converses she wore. She was 17 years old. The pixie cut was in fashion, a short hairstyle like Audrey Hepburn. She got her hair cut, she came home, and her father kicked her out of the house. He said, I know what you've been doing. I know you've been smoking cigarettes, and I know you've been hanging out with people who do terrible things. You're not my daughter anymore. He didn't even let her pack her clothes. He kicked her out of his house. She was forced to go live with an aunt. And she didn't see him for a long time thereafter, and she never darkened the doors of a Pentecostal church again. Instead, she went to Southern Baptist churches. And she maintained some of her holiness ways. She went to my church. And that's how I saw her every Sunday. She would sit on the front row, and she would hold a tambourine with ribbons on it. And that tambourine would get to shaking when the music was upbeat, singing songs like, when the trumpet of the Lord shall sound, and time shall be no more, and the glory of his resurrection fair. When the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. She would shake that tambourine on 2 and 4. And Pentecostals are known for accenting 2 and 4. It is not that way in the Southern Baptist Church. In the Southern Baptist Church, we clap on 1 and 3. It sounds like we are marching off to battle. In fact, we do have songs about marching off to battle. Onward, Christian soldiers marching on to war, with the cross of Jesus marching on before. We like to sing songs about doing battle. A lot of people thought she was crazy, because she did strange things in church. When the music got to going pretty good, she would pick that tambourine up and she would rattle it, and it sounded like a holy rattlesnake. And she would dance a little bit, and the ribbons would would move in the air, and she was the only one in the entire service dancing. Southern Baptists do not dance. Southern Baptists do not have premarital sex because it might lead to dancing. And after church was finished, every single week she would wander up and down the aisles and she would hug people's necks. She would not leave anybody to chance. She would hug everyone she knew and she would ask about how they were doing. She would listen to what they said. She had brilliant blue eyes and she was just a little bit eccentric. She would quote scripture because she knew it better than you did, because she had to memorize all sorts of passages of the Bible during her childhood. And try as she did to let go of some of that, you can't get rid of the things you learn as a child. And so she was our Southern Baptist / Pentecostal, and people just knew what they were going to get. She was married to a man named Jimmy. Jimmy had curly black hair that he let grow a little bit long. He worked on cars for a living. He drove an old car, which he had rebuilt the engine 3 separate times. Sometimes he came with her to church, but most times he didn't. He was the kind of man who didn't feel comfortable in church. And if he did come to church with her, you could normally find him standing on the front porch just after service had ended, or even before service had ended, and he was lighting a cigarette. And us boys would follow him out there. We'd sneak out and we'd follow him and stand on that church porch. He'd be the first one to fill that porch with smoke. And he would show us his inner form of his left arm. And there was a tattoo of a woman on it. She had her knees pressed together and her arms behind her head interlocked. And she was smiling. And if he flexed the tendons and muscles in his forearms, it looked like she was jiggling. We loved that tattoo. And when Miss Tilly would come out, she'd say, "Jimmy, pull your sleeve down." He'd pull his sleeve down and that girl would disappear until the next time we saw Jimmy. She believed in angels. I do remember that. I remember one time in particular, she was sitting on the front row and her vision was fixed on the front corner of the sanctuary. My mother had talked to her after service and she said, "I saw angels dancing. I saw angels dancing up there. And I couldn't even focus on the sermon. They were dancing in this room all around. Angels." That woman might have been touched. I don't know. But she was a sweetheart. And when my father passed, the day after my father passed, she was one of the first people on our doorstep. She did not have a casserole dish in her hands, no muffin tins, no plates full of biscuits, no fried chicken like the others who'd been stopping by our house. She had a small vial of peanut oil. She said, "I'm sorry I couldn't find any olive oil, but I got peanut oil. I hope it'll do." And she placed her thumb in the mouth of that vial, and she turned it upside down and got that oil on her thumb, and she pressed her thumb over the door jamb of our home. This gibberish was coming out of her mouth I did not know. Southern Baptists do not speak gibberish. They speak plain-spoken King James English. When in doubt, add TH to the end of any sentenceth, and you are talkingeth in King James Englisheth. She went through our house speaking in these strange voices unto herself with her eyes closed, whispering words I did not recognize, while her husband Jimmy stood in our entryway just waiting. And then she came to me and she emptied a little bit of oil on her thumb. And she squatted down before me and she rubbed her thumb in a sideways motion across my forehead. And she said, "This is to protect you." And then she placed oil on my mother's forehead. She said, "I hope peace will find you. It might not come fast, but I hope it finds you."
She put oil on my baby sister's forehead. And she said, may you not remember the hard times of your life. I got my hair cut by her for a long, long time. She was a good woman. And I can remember sitting in her chair and looking at the photographs of Jimmy and her children, which were taped to her mirror. And I can remember her saying to me when I was a little bit older, after my father had already passed, she said, you know, my favorite Bible story is that story about Joseph. He was such a good kid. He was such a good boy. He was gifted. He had his whole life ahead of him. And his brothers made his life into a living hell. They tried to kill him. I think about him all the time. He almost died, but he didn't. He didn't. And I think about my own life. I think about all the things that could have happened to me. How I could have had a terrible, terrible life because of the things my family did to me. But the worst didn't happen to me. No, I met my husband, Jimmy. I have my kids. The best happened to me when the worst could have happened to me. And she'd spin me around to look at my hair. And she'd look at my eyes, not nose to nose, but look at me in that mirror. Those crystal eyes of hers were fierce. And she said, sometimes I wonder if our life isn't a Bible story. You know, a Bible story and we just don't know it. And she'd finish, and she'd remove the cape from my neck. And she would towel dry my hair a little bit, get the stray hairs off my neck. My mother would pay her, and she would always do the same thing. She would hand that money back to my mother. She'd say, no, it's on the house this week. Every time I ever visited that single wide trailer. Not long ago, I went to a concert, and it was in the park. It was a god-awful rock band. I can't stand rock bands. I can't stand rock music. But it was a fine concert. There were lots of people there. There were lots of fried chicken on blankets. It was outside under the stars. And I saw somebody in the middle of the audience, in the middle of one song, a young girl. She stood up. She had short hair, and she had a tambourine in her hand. A tambourine. And it made me think about a woman I once knew. A woman who once told me that our lives were stories, Bible stories. A woman who married a man with a naked woman on his forearm. A woman whose single wide trailer smelt like menthol lights. Whose husband smoked unfiltered Camels on the porch of the church. A woman who people thought was touched, who was just a little bit off. A woman who wore red Converse tennis shoes and gave everybody with a pulse a bear hug. A woman named Miss Tilly, who saved me from godless haircuts from my mama.
Thanks for listening to Sean of the South. I'm your host, Sean Dietrich, and it has been a real pleasure. Hope you join us next week. That music here behind me right now is The Wooks. Aaron Bubelhauser, C.J. Kane, Arthur Hancock, and Roddy Puckett on the bass. The Wooks have been making noise in Central Kentucky and beyond, and they won the prestigious 2016 Rocky Grass Band Competition and placed for the finals in the 2017 Bluegrass Festival Band Competition. To find anything more about what they do, you can visit WookOutAmerica.com. To find the music on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, and any other outlet you can think of online. To find anything more about what I do, you can visit SeanOfTheSouth.com. While you're there, I hope you drop me a line, because I love to hear from my friends. And speaking of friends, whenever somebody says life is hard, I'm always tempted to ask, compared to what?
Say bye.
Adios.
Lady. In an open shiner on a chestnut there with an old pet crow. bear with an old pet crow.